Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. With the dog days of summer here, it's pretty impossible to step outside and not immediately start perspiring. Considering the challenges of climate change, this is surely liable to continue to be a problem for us for more of the annual calendar. As my guest today points out in her new book, it's only been a little more than a century since we've stigmatized body sweat as both unsightly and malodorous, spawning the multi-billion dollar deodorant and antiperspirant industries. Sarah Everts is a professor of science journalism at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. Her work has appeared in Scientific American, Smithsonian, and New Scientist magazines, among others. Her new book, based on years of research and global travel, is called The Joy of Sweat, The Strange Science of Perspiration. Among other events, Everts participated in saunas across different cultures. She had her own body odor and sweat glands categorized and enumerated, and even participated in a smell dating event in Moscow in which participants choose who they want to go on a date with based on odor rather than appearance. The Joy of Sweat adds up to an amazingly informative, interesting, and funny new book. Journalist and author Sarah Everts is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Sarah Everts, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by having you just tell us about the science of sweat. This book was so interesting, both funny and interesting in terms of your travels, but I was amazed, for example, to learn that really humans are basically the only animals that do sweat. I mean, it's not entirely true because other animals have sort of slightly different manifestations of it, but I guess people who know a lot more about animals know, for example, that furry creatures like dogs, you know, pant to get rid of their extra body heat. But tell us what scientists think is the purpose of sweating.
Well, the reason we sweat is so that we don't die of heat stroke. So it's to make incremental changes to our body temperature. Effectively, what happens is your floodgates open, you sweat out onto your skin, and your body heat is evaporating the water in your sweat out into the atmosphere, effectively whisking unnecessary heat away. And meanwhile, you have blood swishing by. It's why when, you know, people with light skin get really hot, they turn red because your blood vessels are up against your skin and it's bringing hot blood from your interior to the surface of your skin, which can be cooled down by that evaporation. And then that cooled blood goes back into your interior. And, you know, what really distinguishes humans in terms of our sweating is that, first of all, it's incredibly efficient as a way to control temperature. And we do it really bountifully. So there are a couple of other animals that rely on kind of a sort of sweat to evaporate away their heat. That's like horses and cows, but they are not sweating as much and it's not as efficient. And the efficiency is all related to the fact that we're naked. We are the naked ape. And so we have this enormous surface area off of which we can cool. And, you know, compare that to the dog you just mentioned. They only have a tiny surface area, their tongue, off of which they can evaporate water and saliva. And all that little tiny space of the tongue is cooling down their whole body, which, as you can imagine, is not nearly as efficient as humans, which means we can do this other amazing thing that many other animals can't, which is cool down while on the run. This helped us in our evolutionary history because you can imagine that many of the animals we wanted to hunt back in the day on the savannah could sprint away faster than us. But they would eventually have to stop to cool down, whereas we can, you know, run along and cool down simultaneous to our running, catch up with them, forcing them to run again and again and again until they, you know, die of heat stroke or are easy to kill. And, you know, the modern day equivalent of this is, you know, the fact that we can run marathons. So that's why sweating is so, you know, efficient and why it's kind of humanity's superpower in the animal kingdom.
Yeah. And you really, I think, express that pretty well in the book. I mean, you cover a bunch of animals and how they get rid of excess heat. But one that really stood out to me was, I guess, these doves who live in the desert. Because they actually have to cool their eggs. Most birds we think of as keeping their eggs warm, but these doves have to cool their eggs in order to preserve the young birds. Tell us how that works and what's going on there.
Right. Well, desert temperatures are so incredibly hot that, you know, they don't want to end up with hard-boiled progeny. They want live progeny. And, you know, in order to be safe from predators, they often nest very high up. But this is also, you know, very exposed to the desert sun. And amazingly, the way that pigeons cool down is to rely on this evaporation of bodily fluids. But in this case, they're not actually releasing something like sweat from sweat glands. They're actually just like pushing water through the surface of their skin. So effectively, they achieve the same end result as humans do, which is to, you know, cool down through water evaporation, but they're not using sweat. They're just actually having their skin get leaky between cells and having, you know, interstitial fluid, you know, the fluid that's just keeping their bodies wet inside come out.
But aren't they, amazingly, in a desert environment, they're able to sort of cool their body temperature something like 10 degrees. I mean, it's something truly incredible. Yeah, which is just, it's just astonishing. I have to ask about one more animal because we can't get away from this because we always think of the camel, right, as who, I guess, in a cliche fashion or famously can go long periods of time without drinking water. But you point out that they actually, how did they regulate their body temperature? And I was surprised to learn about their humps.
Yeah, so they have fat in their humps, right? And instead of heating their bodies up, they can also use that fat as insulation to keep it cool. So that's kind of like a cooling parasol for them, for their internal organs. But, you know, even so, over the course of a day, a camel can actually let its body temperature soar. And, you know, that's a pretty weird and amazing feat for a camel. They don't actually have to keep it in a strict small window of temperature like we do so that we don't die of heat stroke. They can, you know, let their internal temperatures, you know, spike to 109 Fahrenheit for, you know, a long period of time.
Yeah, just, again, so different than us. It's so surprising. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Sarah Everts, who is a science journalist. Her new book is called The Joy of Sweat, The Strange Science of Perspiration. Sarah Everts is also a professor of science journalism at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. Sarah, this book was, I mean, in addition to being incredibly informative, is really fun and funny. And you, I mean, you did some incredible research traveling all over the world. So, I mean, I know you've been asked about this, but I have to ask about smell dating. And you went all the way to Moscow, Russia, to do this is kind of speed dating, but with smells. You got to tell us what this was like or what it actually was.
Yeah, it was certainly one of the most unusual and weirdest experiences of my life. But yeah, so the idea of smell dating is that, you know, when you're looking for a date and whether this ends up being a one night stand or, you know, a partnership for life, there's going to be a make or break moment. And that moment is when you smell the body odor of that person, right? Either you're going to like it and want to continue or nope. And so effectively the premise is that, you know, why not triage based on body odor instead of, you know, how somebody looks or shared hobbies. How this works in practice is that you show up at one of these events, and honestly, they've been around the world. I know there's been events in New York and London, Rio de Janeiro, Berlin. This one was in Moscow. And the first thing that happens is I was given a wet wipe to remove any perfume or deodorant, antiperspirant that I was wearing. Next, the organizers take you through some pretty hardcore calisthenics, like we were doing burpees and other, you know, high intensity interval training. And once you have worked up a sweat, they then hand out cotton pads and you dab your parts. And those cotton pads that hold your sweat go into a jar, and the jars are numbered, and only you know the number, and only the organizers know the number. And then all the jars are put on a table, and it's kind of like a sniffing free-for-all. And the idea is that you pick, you know, the top five body odors that you smell as, you know, the ones that you liked the most. And if, for example, I picked your body odor and you picked mine, then it would be a match. And this being Moscow, we would get a bracelet that led us into an all-you-can-drink VIP cocktail lounge where they were serving, you know, vodka berry cocktails to find out whether, you know, the optics and, you know, the shared love of, you know, books or taxidermy or whatever other hobbies you have also match up.
Well, so, and you wound up with, I think, another suitor who was also interested in the person that I think you enjoyed the smell of the most. Do I have that? I might have that slightly backwards, or two people might have been vying for you, but what
sure.
wound up happening?
Oh, no, I wish two people were vying for me. No, I got matched with one person, and it was this beautiful woman. I, you know, prefer men myself, but and that was what I actually found so delightful about this event is, you know, there is no distinguishing of, you know, gender identity or, you know, sexual orientation or anything like that. It is a, you know, what body odors do you like? And anyway, she was also matched with a very tall, lovely, gangly guy who, you know, very quickly was talking about how he, you know, volunteers at a dog shelter in his spare time. And I'm like, damn it. He's going to win her heart. But yeah, she was, her body odor, I remember, it was interesting. It was like this very familiar and nostalgic. And when I sniffed it, it just felt like somebody familiar, like I liked them. And, you know, when I was smelling through all of the other jars, you know, some of them were similar to that. You know, there was like a familiarity, a pleasantness. Some of them to me smelled like very nasty Pong. And there was one actually where I sniffed it and I was just like, hello. That was number 15. But I didn't get matched with that person.
Okay.
So clearly the feeling wasn't mutual.
It was unrequited smell attraction. That was what was so interesting
exactly.
to me. Okay, well, and then you, I guess, I don't know if it was on this part of the same journey, but you also spent time both in at least Germany and Finland, two cultures that have a strong predilection for sauna behavior. And there's quite a bit on this. Now, there's purported medical benefits to sauna, but I guess tell us, and what was very surprising to me, I guess, is just how different the culture of sauna is in those respective countries, which as, you know, North Americans, we probably think, oh, you know, Germany and Finland aren't that far apart. They probably, you know, but they couldn't be more different in how they approach the sauna. Can you share some of those differences?
Oh, absolutely. I know it's really fascinating. So Finland is, you know, the place where we get the word sauna, although they would say sauna. And, you know, they're very kind of purist with their sauna ceremony. You go in and you can pour water on the rocks. This is called a lörli. And, you know, a huge gust of steam comes up. But, you know, when you're actually in the sauna, there's this thing called like sweatiquette, like etiquette of sweating. And, you know, this is where things are really different between Germany and Finland. So, first of all, in Germany, most saunas are completely naked and co-ed. So you're going in and you're seeing everything. And in fact, Germans think that wearing a bathing suit in a sauna is unhygienic. And so you're actually verboten from wearing a bathing suit in a sauna. In Finland, either the saunas are not co-ed, and that's when you can go naked, or you wear a bathing suit. So they're a little bit, a bit more prudish there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are some other really fascinating differences. So, for example, in Germany, the sauna is sacrosanct. If you, you know, are chatting with a friend in the sauna, you get shushed in like only the way that, you know, you can be Teutonically shushed. That's a serious shush. Whereas in Finland, you know, people, you know, are stereotypically not very loud or gregarious, but in the sauna, people are chatting each other up. You can like make friends in a sauna. And so there's like these kind of wonderful cultural differences that you see between, you know, these two countries. And, you know, meanwhile, in Germany, when they pour water on the rocks to get that big pulse of steam that kind of, you know, increases the humidity in the room, something that also happens in Finland, what they'll do in Germany is add, you know, a little bit of essential oils so that burst of steam, you know, is scented with clementine or eucalyptus. So, you know, there's all these different ways in which, you know, these ceremonies differ. Also in Germany, they'll like swing a towel around. There's these people called Aufgussmasters. And so once that room is scented with steam that, you know, smells of clementine, the Aufgussmaster will take a towel and whip it around pizza style to kind of get the air really moving so that you're, you know, being hit by these gusts of hot, smelly, in a good way, you know, air. And then they'll kind of do a towel dance with that, you know, as part of the whole ceremony. And then there's even competitions where these Aufgussmasters with their towel dances will come in and actually perform theater as part of the whole Aufguss ceremony. So yeah, in Finland, it's just, you know, water and steam. In Germany and elsewhere in Europe, things get dialed up to a whole nother level.
Yeah, that was that Aufguss theater was what was really struck me as, like, you know, I guess for my, you know, pedestrian middle American mores, was like so out there. And I thought, you know, I've been to Germany, I just don't remember. It's not like something that I guess was advertised. You sort of had to be in on the culture to probably know about that or have some journalistic cred to find out about that, huh?
Well, you know, the Aufguss ceremonies are happening at pretty much every sauna in Germany, but this Aufguss theater, because, you know, it requires a sound system, like they're dancing to music, it requires costumes, sometimes special effects, sometimes a Videotron. Those are extremely rare, and you kind of have to go to special competitions and be in the know. But the Aufguss, this experience of the scented steam and the towel dance, that's actually very prominent. It's often on the hour, every hour at most German saunas.
Absolutely amazing. Well, you're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and my guest today is journalist and author Sarah Everts, whose new book is called The Joy of Sweat, The Strange Science of Perspiration. And Sarah Everts is also a science journalism professor at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. And so in talking about saunas, we're thinking about sweat as a health benefit, you know, sort of sweat it out. And these traditions go back, you know, centuries. This gets to kind of one of the fundamental points of your book, which is that sweat is natural. Sweat is this unique human superpower, as you phrased it. And yet societally, we still have this shame about sweating. And in fact, we spend billions of dollars to try to cover up our sweat, to prevent sweating in one hand and then to pour fragrances over it. So you've done some investigative work in that regard, too. So what kind of conclusions could you share with our listeners around that whole set of industries?
Yeah, the $75 billion deodorant and antiperspirant industry, it really fascinates me that, you know, in just 100 years, we have gone from being a culture that didn't think we needed these products to, you know, people who generally use them on a daily basis. And the way that deodorants and antiperspirants work is actually really interesting and related to the, you know, invention of antiseptics. So the reason that we smell is not the salty floods pouring out of our bodies that help us cool down. There's another sweat gland that appears at puberty or gets active at puberty in armpits. And that sweat is kind of waxy and more like earwax rather than, you know, the salty floods. And when it emerges from your pores, it's relatively odorless. And the bacteria living in your armpits eat it, and their metabolic byproducts, which is just kind of a scientific euphemism for, you know, bacterial poop, is what makes us smell. And so deodorants and antiperspirants effectively fight that bacteria. So deodorants contain antiseptics that will kill the bacteria living in your armpit, at least for a time, so that they can't dine on your sweat and turn you stinky. Whereas antiperspirants clog the pores physically, effectively cutting off the buffet of sweat to the bacteria that would eat it and then turn you stinky. And, you know, these products are being invented and developed at the turn of the 20th century. But at that point, nobody thinks they need anything more than, you know, soap and water and perhaps a little bit of perfume. And it's only when a high school student who was trying to market a product called Odor Oh No hires a New York-based advertising firm called J. Walter Thompson, who had just hired a former traveling Bible salesman to their Ohio office. And, you know, they put this guy on the case to try and sell Odor Oh No. And, you know, he comes up with this idea that effectively puts the shame and the stink and the fear of sweat in America. And it ends up being this advertisement that is published in Ladies Home Journal, and it features, you know, a beautiful woman and her kind of neckline and shoulder line. And it, you know, begins, you know, within the curve of a woman's arm. And it goes on to say that, you know, this should be this beautiful, dainty thing. And yet it is not. It is stinky. And not only are you stinking, but people are gossiping about you, and that this is going to interfere with your ability to get yourself a husband. It was 1919. And so many readers of Ladies Home Journal, where this ad appeared, were offended that they, you know, were canceling their subscriptions to the magazine. But many more readers were, you know, quite affected by the ad itself. And soon, Odor Oh No is spiking in its sales. And soon many of the other nascent deodorants and antiperspirants that were being developed at the time also borrow this strategy called whisper copy, which is effectively, you know, manufactured humiliation. It's putting the fear of social isolation in people in order to sell a product. And, you know, initially the target was women. And then by the 30s, when they've saturated that market, they, you know, still want to be making more money. And they're like, what else can we do? Bing! Men also stink. And, you know, it's the 30s. And instead of threatening, you know, isolation in love, right? They threaten that, you know, you're going to be excluded from job opportunities because it's the Depression. And so, you know, many of the first ads for men talk about, you know, if you're stinky in the boardroom, you're not going to get that promotion, or you're not going to be able to even keep your job. So, yeah, you know, fast forward to now, and these strategies of, you know, social isolation are being used mixed and matched for, you know, everybody around the world. So, yeah, it's interesting to me, and kind of a shame that, you know, we've all kind of, in a way, succumbed to this marketing strategy. You know, myself included, I also want to fit in, and you know, I still use these products, but I try to remain keenly aware that I'm using them because I exist in a society that stigmatizes sweat.
Well, I'm thinking of, there's kind of almost like a bifurcated messaging now where, you know, I can think of one tagline that sticks with me. I don't even know what product it's for, but it's like, never let them see you sweat. And on the other hand, we glorify sweating in the exercise industry. So, you know, the way our market is segmented, we you know, we're promoting everything. So we're promoting anti-sweat for daily use, but then, you know, we're promoting the goodness of sweat for the exercise value and the health value. And you looked into that too. And that's a whole nother industry. But what kinds of things did you find in this, you know, sports drink in terms of rehydration and sweating?
Oh, yeah, definitely an interesting industry. But I think what's interesting about like these advertising strategies is that they promise that they can control sweat, right? Oh, here, use this product and you'll sweat so much, right? Because you'll be going to the gym or you know, going to the spa, and use this product and you'll never sweat, right? And, you know, I think that's partly because humans are so unable to control our sweat. If you think about other bodily functions that mortify us, you know, a fart or a burp, you know, we can hold those back even just for a microsecond to, you know, relocate and deal with it. Whereas when your body gets the cool down directive, there is nothing that you can consciously do to stop it. And, you know, I think humans writ large don't like to have things out of our control. But especially now in this era of, you know, curated personalities, curated image, online image, we do not like to have how we look externally out of our control. So I think that that's part of the strange appeal, or the strange desire to, you know, control sweat. But in terms of the sports drink industry, yeah, I find this to be fascinating and hilarious. that there's an entire industry that purports to be able to give you liquids that will, you know, perfectly replenish sweat, because I'm sure everybody listening has tasted sweat. It is incredibly salty. I could never dream of drinking an entire cup of my own sweat or anybody else's. And, you know, so this idea of replenishing your electrolytes with a sports drink, yeah, certainly there's some salt in there, but for them to put salt levels that are, you know, anywhere close to replenishing what we lose when we sweat a lot, you have to add so much more sugar to make that palatable. And even so, you can't get that high enough that you are effectively drinking, you know, flat soda. And, you know, I think it's telling that many of the analysts who look at the sports drink industry group sports drinks with, you know, soda pop or, you know, soft drinks, however you happen to call it. Because effectively, you know, these drinks, these sports drinks are, you know, if you look at them chemically, pretty much just flat soda. So yeah, if you want to drink that stuff, great. I personally would rather not put the calories right back into my body, by, you know, drinking a really sweet drink. As, you know, many researchers have pointed that, you know, if you need to replenish your electrolytes, that typically happens by eating salty foods, not by drinking them. And that, you know, water generally suffices, thank you very much, to, you know, rehydrate you after a heavy sweat.
Well put. Well, Sarah, I want to just pivot here for a second and ask you about your work as a journalism professor, because I learned that you also kind of study misinformation. I won't call it as a science, but to how to combat misinformation. Can you share with us some of the work you're doing in that regard?
Yeah, sure. So some of this is subsequent to the pandemic. You know, in the early days, I was involved in polling to look at, you know, what kind of misinformation and fake information about COVID-19 was circulating. And now I'm working on a project to look at vaccine hesitancy or to fight it, actually, by using virtual reality to explain how vaccines work. So I just got funded with some colleagues at Carleton University to effectively take people on a virtual reality trip into a vaccine to understand not just how the active ingredients work in your body to teach your immune system how to fight the virus, but why some of the other ingredients are added. Because, like, I think that there are a lot of questions about, you know, why do we need all these different things? So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to working on that.
Well, I will definitely be on the lookout for that. Well, the name of the book is The Joy of Sweat, the Strange Science of Perspiration, and it's by my guest today, Sarah Everts, who's an author and science journalist, also a professor of journalism at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. Sarah Everts, thank you so much for joining us.
It was really a pleasure.
Sarah Everts is a professor of science journalism at Carleton University in Ottawa. Her new book is called The Joy of Sweat, The Strange Science of Perspiration. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.